Good afternoon. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for coming to the second Unitarian Universalist History and Heritage Society lecture to be hosted at General Assembly this year. I am Kathy Parker. I am on the History Society's Board of Trustees, and I edit the Society's journal. May have seen our journal. This is the latest issue. This just came out. We publish one journal a year, and if you become a member of the society, you will get a copy of the journal in the mail. Before I get started with our event for today, I would like to just say a little bit about the UU History and Heritage Society, otherwise known as UUHHS. Okay. So we have a long history. There used to be a Unitarian Historical Society, then a Universalist Historical Society. They joined together in 1978 to form the UU Historical Society. And then in 2011, we joined together with the UU Women's Heritage Society to form the UU History and Heritage Society. So that's why we have such a long name. We really have tried since then to revitalize the work that we do. And we've done that in many ways by hosting every year a Conrad Wright Lecture, which was held here at GA this year, and to try to bring in other speakers. And we're so lucky today to have Dr. Nikki Taylor with us as our speaker. We've also been doing things like hosting... a convocation every 3 years in which we bring in people who are doing work in UU history and present their papers or sometimes dramatizations or poetry or hymns, special hymns and such. And we're having another one in October, October 27 to 30, and it's going to be in the Twin Cities area. This is the brochure for the convocation. There are copies of the brochure on the table at the back wall. Please help yourself if you're interested. There are also brochures for the Historical Society at the table back there. So help yourself to one of those brochures. And if you're interested, there's a form inside. You can fill it out and send it in and become a member. And we're always happy to... invite new members and have you join us. Another project that we're involved in right now is to try to help revitalize the monument in Mount Auburn Cemetery for William Ellery Channing. It has fallen into great disrepair. So that's another little project that we're doing. We look to UU history to preserve our history, to investigate our history, to promote the study of our history, because we believe our history helps inform us about, you know, the struggles that people endured in the past as members of the Universalist or Unitarian religions, and how that can help us and inform us in our own lives today as Unitarian Universalists. So we have one last thing. We have a booth in the exhibit hall. It is booth number 107. So if you haven't been there yet, by all means, go take a look and say hello and see what we have to offer. All right. So it is my very special privilege today to introduce to you our special guest, Dr. Nikki Taylor. She is a historian whose work we have come to admire and are very excited to promote. And we are honored that she has accepted our invitation. Dr. Taylor is no stranger to Ohio. She was born and raised in Toledo, and after completing her BA at the University of Pennsylvania and her PhD from Duke, she began her scholarly career at the University of Toledo, and then for a decade taught at the University of Cincinnati. She is currently a professor of history and dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Behavioral Sciences at Texas Southern University. She has been awarded many prestigious fellowships, including the Fulbright, Woodrow Wilson, and Social Science Research Fellowship. She is author of 3 books, Frontiers of Freedom, Cincinnati's Black Community, 1803 to 1868, America's First Black Socialist, The Radical Life of Peter H. Clark, which is the subject of her talk today. Her newest book, Driven Toward Madness, The Fugitive Slave Margaret Garner and Tragedy on the Ohio, is coming out in December. This book is also featured in the PBS documentary, African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross. Margaret Garner, the subject named in the title, was the inspiration for Toni Morrison's Beloved. Dr. Taylor will be talking to us today about her work on the life of Peter Clark, a 19th century African American abolitionist, activist for public education and the rights of laborers, black and white, and a Unitarian humanist. Dr. Nicole Kirk writes, "Most of us have never heard of Peter Clark, unless we are connected to the First Unitarian Church of Cincinnati, which he joined due to its abolitionist minister, Moncure Conway. But for those who do not know, Clark in his time was one of the most well-known African-American leaders and most powerful and electrifying orators in the state of Ohio. He was the first African-American to publicly claim the title of socialist in the United States. But he also alternately joined the Republican and Democratic parties as needed to serve a cause. In his review of Taylor's book, published in our Journal of Unitarian Universalist History in 2014, Dr. Dan McCannon states that despite Clark's competing political loyalties, he did much good as an educator and as an advocate for enslaved persons. What is remarkable about Taylor's work, from my point of view, is her refusal to impose on her subject any particular assumptions, but rather carefully traced his complicated story in all its complex, sometimes contradictory, and human detail. Clark is largely forgotten, but the scholarly work of Dr. Taylor has brought to light the story of this remarkable black intellectual and activist for human justice and freedom from oppression. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Nikki Taylor.
Thank you so much for that glowing recommendation. I want to thank the Unitarian Universalist Association for what is a very honorable occasion. I'm very honored and humbled to come home. Texas is not home, obviously, and so it feels good to be back home. It really does. I had not been home in a long time, at least a couple of years, so thank you for joining me. It looks like I have some steep competition, including the spiritualism of hip-hop. I don't know how you all made it here. So thank you for choosing this panel of all the ones that are there. I also want to thank Dan McKinnon, who's the person who actually asked me to come. And I also, as always, want to thank my dear friend, the spirit of my dear friend, long departed Walter Hertz, who is the one who dropped crates and crates of Clark materials on my lap, literally, and said, "You have to do this." And I said, "I'm not interested. Who wants to do a book about socialism? It'll never be published." And all of those things were true. It took me a long time to find a publisher. So I'm also very grateful for the University Press of Kentucky, who's the only one that thought this man was worthy of a biography. So thank you. So just lend me a little bit of time and be patient with me. First, I want to start out, how many of you had heard of Peter Clark in this room? Oh my God. You can write a book and still nobody's ever heard of the guy. Yeah, I don't know what else to do. Maybe I should make a movie or a novel or something. I'm not sure. But hopefully by the end of this presentation, you'll leave here with a profound appreciation and sense of indebtedness to this He was literally a giant among men, lived nearly 100 years, not too far from here in Cincinnati. So let me get started. On December 3rd, 1859, just one day after John Brown's execution for his Harper's Ferry raid while attempting to incite a slave insurrection, the Cincinnati German Freeman Society and Arbiter Association held a rally at the German Institute to commemorate and memorialize John Brown's efforts. African Americans entered the German Institute, located in Over the Rhine, carrying a banner decorated with the likeness of Thomas Paine, George Washington, and the American flag, with a simple inscription that read, "In memory of John Brown." The building overflowed literally with multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multi-religious international crowd of women and men. Two-thirds of this crowd were German, another a third were African American. The crowd's diversity is underscored by one journalist who disdainfully remarked that the walls of the galleries were filled with a motley crew of both sexes, diversified by every common hue to the human species. Complementing the physical diversity of the assembly is the fact that the speeches were delivered in three languages. Peter Humphreys Clark, my guy, Moncure Conway, and B. Fromm delivered theirs in English. August Willich, the editor of the Republikaner, the German journal, delivered one in German, and Y. Montaldo delivered one in French. Even more exceptional than the layers of diversity among the assembly of Brown sympathizers in the city of Cincinnati is the fact that this may have been only one or a few times in antebellum history before the Civil War where African Americans and Germans crossed into each other's public spaces. So this was pretty exceptional. Despite their different backgrounds and histories, Brown's martyrdom brought them together for a common objective. Most German radicals who attended the rally that day opposed slavery in principle because they thought it wrong to hold another in bondage. Moreover, the slaveholding class reminded them all too much of the despotism of the aristocratic class in the old country, the same kind they had fled from. John Brown embodied the spirit of their 1848 revolution, and those with the courage to stand against the landed elite and strike out for freedom for the common man. African Americans, on the other hand, were there because they celebrated the life of John Brown and the fact that he had violently struck out against slavery. Never before had any white person done that. By allowing himself to be martyred for the cause, John Brown had made the ultimate statement to end slavery and sacrifice on their behalf. Given the spirit of the day, it is really no surprise that the Cincinnati Volksfront reported the rally under the headline, "Freedom, Equality, and Brotherhood." August Willich, a socialist German radical known in Cincinnati as the reddest of the red, took the platform first. He encouraged listeners to whet their sabers and nerve their arms for the day of retribution. Listen closely to what he said. Whet their sabers and nerve their arms for the day of retribution when slavery and democracy will be crushed into a common grave. Moncure Conway, the minister of what is now the First Unitarian Church, back then the First Congregational Church, followed Willich. He recently had delivered a long sermon at his own body celebrating the martyrdom of Brown. And so in this speech, he believed that Brown's actions signaled the start of a modern-day revolution to end slavery, a revolution which he argued was unparalleled in American history. He ended his by declaring, "We must die or succeed." Peter Clark was up next. He's the only African-American to address the crowd, and when he took the stage, he expressed how honored he was to speak before a congregation of the only freedom-loving people in the city in reference to the Germans, and claimed that the rally was only the second time in his life that he felt truly free. And like Conway before him, Clark invoked a brand of American nationalism. He invoked the spirit of the American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence, But he said, this time we're going to have a revolution, but we're going to secure freedom for all people, which in his mind, the American Revolution had not done. For him, the objective of the unfinished revolution was black freedom. In front of the crowd, he echoed Conway's analysis about the current turn of events by stating, we are in the midst of a revolution. Failure was not an option, he roared. We must fight to the death. As undeniable proof that their enemies waged a war to secure slavery, he pointed to the Dred Scott decision, and he urged the assembly to attack slavery with all the weapons of freemen, inferring the use of actual weapons and violence if necessary. He also threatened that those with hands bloodied by slavery would be sent to hospitable graves. A black man talking like that in America, that's pretty exceptional, okay? So although he was not a violent man under normal circumstances, he indicated at that moment at least that he was prepared to use violence to secure freedom and rights if necessary. With such threats against white elites at that moment in the years leading up to the Civil War, Peter Clark, in my opinion, was the most radical free black man in America. And in a lot of ways, that whole image that I just painted really typifies a lot about his life. Peter Clark, 1829 to 1925, was one of the foremost African American orators in the 19th century. The Indianapolis Freeman at one point listed him among the top 10 most notable blacks, up there with Crispus Attucks, Nat Turner, and Frederick Douglass. And so it's just really sad in a way that history has forgotten such a giant. Oratory is a crucial part of who he was as an intellectual and activist. He was a second-generation free black, a radical intellectual, an abolitionist, a radical abolitionist, an immigrationist, meaning he espoused black people leaving the country at one point, a black nationalist, a civil rights activist, a teacher, a journalist, a principal, and a politician, all in the slightly under 100-year lifespan. He possessed an unfaltering commitment to the advancement of his community through his fearless work for abolition, equal access to education, which was not a right for blacks at the time, racial equality, political power, and full citizenship for all citizens. He used the press, he was an editor, the classroom, he was a teacher, and the podium as an orator. All of those were his forums for discussing African-American status, and they were also vehicles to secure rights for all the above oppressed peoples. But what a lot of people who do know a lot about him, what they don't know, for roughly the first half of his public career, he embodied a radical tradition, meaning he hoped not simply to reform. If most of us are honest with ourselves, most of us are just simply reformers, right? We just want to tweak the system a little. But he wanted to drastically remake society in every imaginable way. Radicals aim not just for the absence of chains, but a new society altogether. In this vein, he pursued a vision of America in which the highest ideals of freedom, democracy, and equality reign. While he endorsed violence at the John Brown rally, the truth was that he hoped that politics would be the means to make these sweeping, radical, and societal changes. To that end, in his life, he joined not one, not two, but three radical political parties. I've not even joined one, to be honest. Okay. So all of those political parties wanted nothing short of social or economic revolution. In this lecture, I will demonstrate that his radicalism, which in my book I say kind of ended around 1879, but he was a ripe older guy by 1879, let's be honest, but it was diverse, dynamic, daring, textured, and he defied typification and often even defied boundaries. This is why he is so significant in American history and for all people. Now, what had awakened Peter Clark's impulses? As an Ohioan, I would ask, if I hadn't written the book, What made him radical? I mean, this is Ohio. This is the breadbasket of the country. Like, we're not radicals here. But what made him radical? What had awakened his radical pulse? The virulently and frequently violent, racist, and prescriptive world of 19th century Cincinnati played a role in leading Peter Clark to radicalism, as I argue in my book. He was born a few months before a historic and violent attempt at racial cleansing. One of the first racial cleansing attempts against African Americans, unfortunately, happened in Ohio, in Cincinnati, in 1829. So it's kind of ironic that he's born just a few months before that. Half of Cincinnati's black population was forced to leave in that attempt. Many of them probably ended up here, but a lot of them ended up in Canada, in Upper Canada. Sadly, he would witness at least two other major race riots during his childhood, one in 1836 and an all-out race war in 1841. And it was only a race war because that time African Americans decided to arm themselves and fight back. So this is unprecedented violence that kind of, you know, were at critical junctures of his childhood. The racial violence and repression he witnessed taught him unspoken lessons about the racism and second-class status and citizenship that made his community vulnerable to everything from petty indignities on the street to mob violence and denied education. Certainly, without Cincinnati and its unique brand of racism, repression, exclusion, inequality, we would have no Peter Clark. But racism alone is not enough to radicalize any young mind. Peter Clark's radical consciousness had also been raised by having been born to a free black family with a history of slavery, freedom, and resistance. He had an enslaved grandmother who first began being used for sex at just 14 by her much older slave owner. She gave birth to five of that man's children in Kentucky. But that same grandmother, not completely down and out, her name was Elizabeth, she made sure that her owner and the father of her children freed her and their children in his will. That's pretty exceptional. How'd she do that? She was a boss, right? So once freed, she even had the unmitigated audacity to sue her owner's son, the half-brother of her children, for her back wages, and she won. She was a boss. So that's his legacy, right? He also first actualized, so all of these things are raising his consciousness. He's actualizing his radicalism first through the militant expressions of black nationalism, vowing never to work in a job that would force him to be subservient to whites. He said that in his teen years. Advocating that African Americans immigrate to Africa, which was a minority position for African Americans at the time, and later even advocated that they establish a black republic in Central America that would pressure the U.S. to emancipate African Americans. Like, wow, you know, like just his mind is so attractive to me. He even formed a club that he named the Liberia League, which researched the feasibility of black immigration and made practical plans for black people to just quit America altogether and leave and go to Liberia. He went all the way to New Orleans, got down to New Orleans, was about to board a ship, and decided the ship didn't look like it would make it, so he decided. So he left his immigration plans right there on the port of New Orleans, and he came back to Cincinnati after that. In June of 1855, he launched the Herald of Freedom, which was an abolitionist press. And although it might have been determined as moderate or a little peculiar to African Americans, his Herald ruffled enough feathers among the elite that the conservative Daily Commercial printed an editorial on June 19, 1855, accusing him of being too passionate about abolitionism, as if there was such a thing, and making it too prominent a feature in his journal. The editor of that journal further criticized Clark's paper for focusing too much on racial inequality and how African Americans have been deprived of their social and political rights. But that criticism purely, we don't have extant copies of his paper, but by just reading what happened in the commercial and their response, you can definitely get a sense of what that paper must have been about. But his publishing that press was obviously attracted enough attention that Frederick Douglass, now how many of you have heard of him? Frederick Douglass decided to bring Clark to Rochester to help him edit his own paper, which he did for a while. And so under the tutelage of Frederick Douglass, he got really immersed in some national issues and things like that. And so, you know, this was Douglass's younger protege, and he was preparing him for leadership in the abolitionist struggle. Most importantly, in my opinion, what Douglass granted is he introduced the Cincinnatian to the most radical political party in that moment. It was called, does anybody know? No, not the Republicans. The Radical Abolition Party. The Radical Abolition Party. Now, Douglass introduced Clark to the party and the principals and actually had Clark introduce a speaker or do a little speech at a conference. But basically, what that party stood for was not merely just an abolitionist organization. It was first and foremost a political party. It was designed to elect radical abolitionists who would take the necessary steps to end slavery immediately. So how does it differ from the Republican Party? Does anybody know that? Well, the Republican Party wanted to end slavery in the new territories. So it didn't want slavery to be taken out west. But it didn't really take a position on slavery in Alabama. Okay? So that's why I said it's not too radical. But the Radical Abolition Party wanted to end it everywhere. And not in 5 years, but right now. Okay, so that's what made that party a little extreme. And so Clark was a member of that party. It was a short-lived party. He eventually returned to the Republican Party after that. But like martyr John Brown, Peter H. Clark espoused militant radical abolitionism and revolutionary armed violence in the 1840s and 1850s. He once threatened to cut the throat of a white man who had been sniffing around his father's barbershop looking to find black women to have sex with, okay? So he's like, no, I'll cut your throat. Don't ever come in here disrespecting black women again. He also, as I said earlier, said threatened slaveholders should be sent to hospitable graves. But the fact that his initial step into radicalism would be through the lens of race as a militant black nationalist shouldn't be surprising now that I've described the history in the culture of Cincinnati, right? That's not surprising given where he came from. But nonetheless, although socialism at the time was still young in American history, it was young, nascent organization, nascent movement, it played its part in radicalizing Peter Clark as well. He attended a high school open by a man by the name of Hiram Gilmore, who was a Methodist Episcopal minister. But this man was one of the earliest in the nation to convert to socialist principles. Gilmore and two other men formed an organization called Universal Brotherhood. And the purpose of that organization was to combine resources, a socialist project, and to try to, help the good of the whole. And they founded a little community on the edge of the Ohio River where members and people who lived in the community were dedicated to these socialist principles of the Universal Brotherhood. Unfortunately, a bad flood ended the dreams of that community right there on the shores of the Ohio River just 1 year into the project. But nonetheless, his principal started that community, and his own aunt moved to the community. So certainly all of that had played a role in raising his consciousness about socialism. In addition to that, he served as an apprentice for what people have argued is the most radical couple in America, Thomas and Marie Verney. They were people who lived in Cincinnati briefly. Thomas was a stereotyping a printer, and Marie was she wrote for the Herald of Freedom, a very socialist leaning paper, and they also published a lot of other socialist books at the time. So the socialist couple, and Peter Clark is their apprentice. And so all of that is playing a role. In addition to that, another thing that may have raised his consciousness was just the city itself, Cincinnati. After 1848, the 48ers from Germany pretty much dominated much of the inner core of Cincinnati. They had come as political refugees. About 5,000 of them settled in the city in that period. And they were about one-third of the population. They lived in the area called Over the Rhine, which still exists to this day. If you ever get to Cincinnati, you should go look at it. But a lot of German influences in the city of Cincinnati. Unlike earlier German immigrants, the 48ers resisted assimilation at all costs. And like I said earlier, they had a memory of revolution. So they're just a little bit or a lot more radical than the earlier Germans. While not all 48ers can be defined as radical, some were quite racist and conservative. Those who were embraced some of the most controversial concepts in the 19th century, including immediate abolition, as the people at the John Brown rally were, natural rights for all, racial integration, interracial solidarity, and socialism. At a state convention of German radicals, free thinkers and working men, as their laborers were called, demanded an immediate end to slavery. These German radicals also insisted that free homesteads be given to African Americans, meaning free tracts of land. Hence, never before had any ethnic group in America, and mostly not even African Americans, advocated land redistribution that would benefit African Americans. So it's a precursor to the 40 acres and mule thing, right, that we all know about. And these were Germans that are advocating this. And it's no wonder then that Peter Clark said these were the only freedom-loving people in the city. It's easy to understand why Peter Clark would have been attracted to the dynamism of this community of German-born radicals. His interactions with them pushed him to think beyond America's very narrow definitions of equality and democracy. Moreover, the fact that they possessed a stronger abolitionism and greater sympathy for African Americans than even American white abolitionists proved quite appealing to this young African American. He surely found common bond with them because of their socialist inclinations. The final form of Clark's radicalism that I will discuss today is his free thinking ideology, which provided the bridge to him to embrace Unitarianism. Okay? Clark was introduced to the writings of founding father Thomas Paine, and they had a transformative effect on him. In a lecture at a celebration commemorating the life and writings of the founding father, he highlighted some of the most memorable parts of the Age of Reason. And when people do that as speakers, it's often because those are the things that had a profound effect on them. In that controversial text, Paine, and this is Clark saying that, he condemns organized religion and priests, and accuses the Christian church of having created several myths and then passed them off as bona fide historical accounts. These myths, I'm sorry, that's my little timer. I'm sorry. Okay, these myths included Bible stories about Adam's sin in the Garden of Eden with the snake, the Immaculate Conception, the virgin birth, the crucifixion and resurrection, and the afterlife. Thomas Paine contends in Age of Reason that the works of the prophets mix poetry, anecdote, and devotion. According to him, the only miracles that mattered were those of creation and self-existence. And what arguably may be Paine's most democratic publication, Rights of Man, he advocated the unity and equality of all people. He's probably the only founding father I really admire is Thomas Paine. You have to be honest, okay? So considered seditious in his own lifetime in the late 18th century Europe, Paine's writings were no less threatening to the status quo in Cincinnati in the 1850s. In that period of time, any critical interrogation of the Bible or Christianity, especially in Cincinnati, was considered sacrilegious. Those who committed such acts were deemed heretics and, at worst, I'm sorry, heretics at worst and at best atheists. Paints irreverent critiques of the Bible and Christianity and his rejection of Jesus as Savior led most mid-19th century Americans to brand him an infidel. Paine encouraged his readers to use reason to eliminate contradictions, and so Peter Clark got drunk on all of this Paine writings. And he was brazen enough to celebrate this man publicly. He underestimated the depths of Protestantism in Cincinnati when he agreed to be a keynote speaker of a celebration of Thomas Paine in the 1850s. Because at the time, Cincinnati harbored deep biases against those deemed infidels. Any religious freedom that had been enshrined in the U.S. Constitution didn't seem to exist in Cincinnati at that time. Despite the fact that the city boasted robust religious diversity by then, nativism and Protestantism dominated the tone and climate of the city, which at times reflected a great deal of hostility and derision for immigrants who didn't practice Protestant Christianity. So that would include Catholics, Jews, others with non-Protestant faiths, including Unitarians. And often the city was home to very vicious nativist mobs, which is why I'm a little concerned with our current political climate.
Yes.
Right? Because I've seen this before, like, uh-oh, are we going back to the 1850s? Really? So nonetheless, by then, public sentiment fomented particularly strong against hiring infidels as teachers or in any position where they might have an opportunity to influence people. Clark, as the city's first black teacher, lost his teaching job because of that speech on Thomas Paine and these religious principles. He lost his teaching job, and he eventually got it back, but he spent a lot of time unemployed, and so he got an even sharper appreciation for socialism and the plight of laborers in the time that he was unemployed. But his admiration for Thomas Paine had a lot to do with the fact that he had recently been seen attending Unitarian services at the First Congregational Church and associating with several of its key members. In the mid-19th century, I don't have to tell you all this, but it gave birth to a theological reform movement that questioned the very nature of Christ and his divinity, transcendentalism. This new theology bears great similarity to Paine's deism, because it rejects the standard doctrine of Christianity. But transcendentalist Unitarians, for their part, also rejected the doctrine of the Trinity and instead embraced the unity of the Father, the Son, and Holy Ghost in one being. So at the time, as an AME member, it's a little contradictory for him to suddenly start going to a Unitarian church, the first African-American in Cincinnati, probably Ohio, to go to a Unitarian church. But I think, and I argue this in my book, he was attracted to the intellectualism of the Unitarians. Same reason I'm attracted to Unitarians. You know, it's like, especially for intellectuals and people who are higher thinkers, it's an attractive, very thoughtful faith. I won't even call it a religion, but a faith. But he joined this congregation at a time when most African Americans all over the country deemed themselves either Methodists or Baptists. This peculiarity meant that he had to routinely defend his faith, not just outside of his community, but within his community. At times, a black community turned on him, and the charges of him being an infidel, they reemerged. But this time, black people were calling him an infidel at various junctures in his papers. So what do we make of all of this? Clark's radical activism defies typification. He had layers upon layers upon layers of various forms of radicalism. None of it fit in one box. One just as easily might find him in a pulpit speaking in front of an all-black audience at Emancipation Day Festival, which commemorates freedom for black people, or before an assembly of German immigrants expressing solidarity with John Brown. One might find him railing about Thomas Paine's principles or religious freedom, or about how wage slavery had reduced wage workers to beggars. Clark easily moved between worship services in the AME church and those in the Unitarian congregation. His activism included everything from the Underground Railroad to editing his own abolitionist newspaper. He did everything from protesting in the streets with German radicals and over the Rhine to addressing the Ohio legislature here down the street. His political affiliations ran the spectrum from radical abolitionists to Republican to liberal Republican. Now, they're pretty racist. To socialist to Democrat, they were pretty racist at the time, okay? Clark made an indelible imprint on the political culture and public life of America. His life proves that it is possible for activists to cut across boundaries of race, class, religion, ethnicity, and even partisanship, especially partisanship. Who knew? Even at a moment, at a time when we would think it was impossible, the 19th century. So in a lot of ways, we've gone backwards. These political boundaries are really immovable for some reason these days. His intellectual, political, and activist roots borrowed heavily from several traditions. Very few African-American intellectuals then or now draw simultaneously from so many different schools of thought. At first, his belief in the efficacy and effectiveness of moral suasion, coupled with his use of oratory and the press as forms of protest, are firmly rooted in the abolitionist tradition. In fact, the very word moral suasion, and that's where you get people to think morally about whether or not something is wrong. That's the abolitionist tradition. His formal education in abolitionist schools and in abolition and when working at abolitionist conventions are the sources of that programming. The German working men tradition tutored him in free labor ideals, working class consciousness, and labor activism. He did all of that. I talk about all of that in details in the book. Moreover, German political philosophy is responsible for his socialist ideologies and formal affiliation with socialist political parties. Now, where would I put him on the socialist spectrum? Probably where Bernie Sanders is, a socialist Democrat. He's not, you know, one of those let's move to communist type of socialists, but more of a socialist Democrat because he believed in using politics as a way to affect change. No other leading African-American in this period was influenced by German-speaking immigrants. I can't find another, okay? Thirdly, the British free-thinking tradition, influenced by people like Thomas Paine, governed another aspect of Clark's intellect. It can take credit for philosophies on democracy. He talked so much about humanism. I didn't even know about humanism until I started writing this. I think this biography made me smarter because I learned a lot about your faith, and it took me into free thinking and transcendentalism and all these things that I said before, oh my God, who writes about stuff like that? It's only smart people, and here I was doing it. So it really, right? So it really made me flex my intellectual muscle in a way they didn't teach me at Duke or Penn, oddly enough. So I thank Peter Clark for that. It also, the free thinking ideology also had him questioning the whole concepts of social equality, citizenship. He really thought deeply about what does it mean to be a citizen? Is it just people who are born here? Is it something else? Things that we just take for granted now. We don't really have debates about citizenship unless we're talking about Mexican immigrants, right? So, but we should think more thoughtfully about citizenship and universal humanity. Moreover, that same tradition, the British freethinking tradition, led him to question all received culture, traditional institutions, and values, and led him down the path to Unitarianism, as I said earlier. Finally, the African-American religious, intellectual, and activist traditions developed his philosophies, which I talk about in the book, on manhood, self-help, very conservative, more like Barack Obama in his whole philosophy on self-help. Respect and self-respect and leadership. And so another part of his ideology came from the black church, specifically the AME church, which is, in my opinion, it's just an opinion. I guess they don't count for much. They don't pay me for opinions, but I'll tell you mine. The AME probably would be a rough equivalent to your faith in terms of intellectualism, blending that with activism and seeing the two as inextricably linked. So I'm not an AME, but I tend to gravitate to Unitarian and AME, for whatever, if that helps you, because of these same reasons that Peter Clark was. It just, you want churches that can move something and do something in our society. So nonetheless, Clark gained more than ideology, strategy, and worldviews from these diverse ideological traditions I just summarized. He also built very close, deeply personal alliances with powerful people in these respective activist and thought communities, alliances that factored prominently in his quest for all manner of things. His best friend and mentors came out of that congregational church in Cincinnati, including the future governor, Hoadley, George Hoadley, and also Moncure Conway. Often seen at the Unitarian Church, Peter Clark would be there debating slavery, even while in the midst of the Civil War, debating what freedom would mean for all the millions of African Americans. He also found camaraderie among German socialist radicals. August Village meant a lot to him, and he was often speaking at these people's funerals, including Village. He also, another thought community was the abolitionist community, very close to Levi Coffin, who named himself the president of the Underground Railroad, emphasis on named himself. And then free thinkers like Johann Stallo, who was one of the large free thinkers in the Cincinnati community. But what makes him so exceptional, as I said earlier, is the ease by which he moved through these various communities, in spite of all of these other divides in that period. To be honest, there hasn't been a black man like him before or since. And I think in closing, what his life teaches us, it dares us to make our life mean something. It dares us to find that radical side of our own selves in all the manners of social injustice that are dear to us. And not just to take the easy path, but to take the path less traveled. Thank you. Where are my Cincinnatians?
Over here.
Yes, thank you. Let me tell you, I'm so indebted to that city and community. Thank you all for supporting me, as they always have. A lot of them come to a lot of my talks. So thank you, Ed, and others who drove up here, probably not just to see me, but thank you for coming and bypassing the hip-hop panel for me. Any questions?
So, yes, we have a mic here in the middle of the room, and we'd appreciate, if you have a question, to just come up to the mic.
Did you come across any pictures of him or of the city?
I do. You know, I should have had all of that, a PowerPoint. I'm not as good with that. It's all in the book. I found Walter Hertz found his ancestors, right? Or no, predecessors. What do you call them when they come after you?
Descendants.
Right.
His descendants.
His family. And so he did, and that's why it's always good to have a white and black working together. He got things that I couldn't get. So the family now has crossed the color line, and they're white, or at least they claim to be. And so, and I probably would have outed them. Like, so it's good. Walter was very classy, and he was very careful, and so he was very private, and he got pictures from the family. And so those pictures are in my book. I owe him such a debt for all the work that he did. There are pictures of Peter Clark and his wife and his children, who also, you know, a lot of them, even back then, were beginning to start to pass, because he himself is very fair, very short in stature. And so each generation, they just, you know, started to pass for various reasons. But yeah, lots of pictures of Cincinnati in the book, and George Hoadley, and Taft was another friend of his. And so, yeah, sorry about that. I have the book here if you want to look in it. I have a copy of my own if you want to look at it to see who he is. But thank you for that question. Hi.
Hi. I must admit I've never heard of 18th century socialism. It's very interesting. but I have heard of the 19th century socialism, I guess is what I'm talking about.
Right.
But I have heard of 20th century communism, early and mid 20th century communism. And I was just wondering if you came across any relationship between the 19th century socialism and the 20th century communism, American communism.
No, the only similarities they might have in common is the fact that there were these attempts at these socialist Fourier phalanxes that I talk about in my book, where they're starting to live together. They have a common one-node exchange system, very sophisticated. I talk about a lot of this in my book. So they, you know, but these are communities. They're not larger cities or anything like that. But as a whole, I have friends that write about 20th century socialism and communism in the U.S., and they hadn't heard of Peter Clark, and I don't think they respected him much after they read the book, because I guess he wasn't as radical as the 20th century people. And so you have to put everything in its proper context. For that moment, he was pretty radical, right? Just like at some moment, for black people in segregation era, for them to sit, you know, in the front of the bus was radical, right? So everything is radical in its day. So, yeah. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Reverend Barbara Queeman. I'm the outgoing minister in Reston, Virginia, and I'm a member of this board, so thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You addressed Frederick Douglass. He had connections with Frederick Douglass. So my question is about connections of anti-slavery reformers. Was there any particular network of connections? Frederick Douglass was in Rochester, New York.
Right.
So any particular connections or lines of networking between Cincinnati and upstate New York in the 50s?
Yes.
And the context of my question is, I work on women's rights in the 1850s,
mm-hmm.
and the upstate New York women, led by Katie Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, they were on lecture circuits that went all the way through Ohio.
Right.
And I see these connections, Ohioans and New York women supporting
right.
one another. So that's my
same
larger
thing.
Question.
Yes.
There were anti-slavery networks
yes,
in the same way?
There was an anti-slavery network that went from obvious Ohio, Cincinnati mostly, up to upstate New York, Buffalo and Rochester. And so there were several Ohioans that Frederick Douglass used for his lecture circuits. He sent Peter Clark out, but the crowds weren't that impressed by him, not because he wasn't a brilliant orator, but at the time, people wanted people who had experience in slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted them
yeah.
to talk about the
yeah.
horrors, and he couldn't do it. I mean, what did he know about slavery? He was an educated black
yeah.
man in the 19th
yeah.
century.
Yeah.
So, yes, and then it went even as far south as New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And so that whole
mm-hmm.
corridor, I think the networks follow the way of the steamboat, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
that was the easiest way to get around. And so
yeah.
I think that made a lot of sense that they would take the Erie to the Ohio River or whatever else. So.
And then another particular mm-hmm. Unitarian connection. Did he know Sam May, who was in Syracuse, and an abolitionist supporter?
You know, the most mm-hmm. difficult part of this project is when I went to Rochester, I thought I would find some letters somewhere,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
I found nothing there. And mm-hmm. I should say to the rest of you, Peter Clark doesn't have any papers.
Mm-hmm.
I had to find all these little bitty pieces
yep.
of him
yep.
In newspapers. And so it's a political biography for that reason. I don't know much about how he loved his wife or what he thought
mm-hmm.
of his kids. I don't know that. But and so the pieces of this are just very scant. Even
mm-hmm.
Douglass, I looked at all of his papers. He doesn't even mention Peter Clark.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what's that about? But John Mercer Langston, who you all know, another Ohioan, I found some stuff about Peter Clark and his papers, which are at Fisk. So, you know, so, yeah, I don't know if he knew Sam May. It doesn't mean that he didn't know
yeah.
him. It just means I don't know if he knew him.
I relate. That's parallel to the biography I'm writing right now. There's no primary sources.
Yes.
I have to look elsewhere. So
yeah.
I relate.
I mean, it's just
I feel
most,
your pain.
Yeah, it's the most difficult thing you can do. But
yeah.
if we don't do it, who'll do it? Right? So we have to be committed to these things where you don't have a nicely set of diary papers with a ribbon, you know, and you know, so it's just really troubling, but you stick with it, you know, it's worth it in the end.
Hi.
Hey. I'm Tony Johnson. I'm minister in Ridgewood, New Jersey, and
I
do a lot of reading in radicalism
mm-hmm,
in American
mm-hmm.
history, and
mm-hmm.
as I was looking at this and hearing you speak,
mm-hmm.
I was thinking of John Simon's book, The S Word,
mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. on the history of socialism mm-hmm. in this country. Mm-hmm. And he spends a lot of time on those Midwestern German mm-hmm. radicals.
Yeah.
Who
yeah.
were much more radical than you described
right.
Clark as being.
Right.
Many of them
right.
having fled the 1848-49 yeah. revolutions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, and so is there... I'm going to go back to you know
right.
that book
right.
and see if he's mentioned there somewhere, because he did a lot of digging to get that book there
yeah,
with some characters who were also not well documented.
Yeah, he may have mentioned him. Not many. The thing is, a lot of the German radical, these German newspapers obviously are in German.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm from Toledo. They didn't teach us German. And I learned French, so I had to rely on people. And you don't know how well they really know German, so they read it. He says here that, and I'm like, oh, my God, is this really what the thing says? But it's really painstaking. I think most, there's a treasure trove in these German newspapers yeah. in Cincinnati. And admittedly, I was limited because of my huge handicap. So it's going to take a German historian to get in there and dig more about these connections. Peter Clark might be even more radical than even what I found in the regular, you know, English newspapers. So I don't think we should just limit it to what I found. There's so much to be written once somebody has the intestinal fortitude to get into those sources, which are heretofore untapped.
Well, that sounds like a great project for someone who knows German, which doesn't include me. But thank you so much.
Thank
this
you.
A very interesting presentation, I might
thank
say.
Thank you.
I'm Bob Freer from the Gathering of Northern Hills in Cincinnati.
Oh, hi.
And we have a 93-year-old black man who is an original Tuskegee Airman.
Oh, I know him. Leslie, tell him I said hi.
I do that because his grandfather was the first black Unitarian
yes.
minister in Cincinnati.
I know him very well.
Okay.
I miss him. Can
okay.
you tell him I miss him and give
I'll
him my
that.
Love? Yes.
Thank you.
Look at how small Cincinnati is. Hi.
Hi. I want to echo previous comments and thanking you. It was a fascinating story.
Thank
and
you.
Embarrassed to say I'm one of the people that never heard of him before. My name's Jerry Ross. I'm from...
Okay.
Massachusetts and
okay.
New England. In listening to your story, one of the things that keeps coming through my mind is how did this black, free-thinking, socialist man survive? How did he not become a target, or did he? Were there ever any incidents or situations that were... you know, where he was identified and threatened. And finally, I didn't hear anything about his latter years. What about his latter years?
That, whoa. He was not targeted, except by black people. Targeted by black people in his latter years. I kind of left the story unfinished. His latter years, he became equally conservative and distasteful, not that I'm supposed to have opinions as a historian, but he became one of the first black Democrats. I'm like, which I argue in my book is probably why we don't remember you now, Peter Clark, because he became a black Democrat at a time when they were lynching black people. How does one wrap their mind around that, right? Mm-hmm. So he, his latter years were spent advocating the end of Reconstruction, just all kinds of troubling, unsettling things that I like to hide. No, just kidding. It's in the book, too. I talk about it in the book. He also advocated and he fought hard against integration. Integration. He did not want the schools to become integrated. So, yeah, right? It's like you guys have the expression I have. Right. That's he didn't want, and it was self-serving. He was a teacher. He didn't want to lose his jobs because he knew integrated schools, white kids, but he believed, and he said it, white parents are not going to send their kids to black teachers. So he was fighting for his job. So when Cincinnati was one of the last cities in Ohio to get integrated public schools, so he left and went to St. Louis. That was a little bit less progressive than Cincinnati, which was not very progressive. So, yeah, he did that. What else did he do? He fought against civil rights bills, all kinds of, yeah. But it's good because, you know, if he had been a hero throughout, I think that's easier book to write. So it just really flexes you as a historian when you come to a project and this is a hero and then you start to hate the person. And then you have to give a punctuated lecture where you hide all the bad stuff, but then you have a smart guy that figures it out. So, yeah, I talk about all of that in the book. And I argue about our imperfect selves. But he, a quest for personal political power, did it. And he did all kinds of vile things. He talked about the first black representative, George Washington Williams, in the state of Ohio. He was the first black representative. We should all celebrate him. Clark was vicious. I found out in the presidential papers, okay, he had written all kinds of vicious letters about this guy, telling him he was a drunk, he didn't take care of his kids. It's only like three black politicians, Peter Clark. Could you not disparage one of the three? But anyway, I digress. So, yeah, all of these things. And I talk about all of that. But he wanted to be those. He wanted to be the first black representative. He wanted to be, and he never got those things. He ran for political office under the Socialistic Labor Party. Political power was fleeting. It's a sad story of a failed politician. And so that's,
I have a simple, I hope, detail question.
Okay.
And you were talking about Hiram Gilmore founding a community on the Ohio River. Do you know what's the name of that?
I'll talk to you about it later. It's
okay.
In my book.
It's in the book.
Getting early.
What popped into my head was New Harmony, but that was in Indiana.
No, it's not New Harmony. Yeah. It's called the Universal Brotherhood Phalanx, okay. Is what okay. It is.
Okay.
Yeah, but I have the book and I'll show you the pictures and I'll. Yeah, okay. It's definitely, it's called the Universe. And there were several along the Ohio River, but this one, it had all of black upper-class people in there. They had tradesmen and whites that had a lot of money. And so it looked like it would work. But then the Ohio River flooded and broke up their buildings, and they drowned in the river. I was like, what bad luck. So that's what ended that socialist project right there on the river. It's called the Universal Brotherhood Phalanx.
Thank you. Great talk.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is James. Just graduated from Union Theological, and I was wondering...
Get closer to the mic.
Hello.
Hi.
My name is James. I go to Mount Kisco Unitarian Fellowship.
Okay.
I was just wondering if the society created by some of Peter Clark's contemporaries, being Walter Rauschenbusch for socialism and maybe Ida B. Wells for the fearless abolition and the anti-lynching, mm-hmm. whether the scene created by those two was powerful enough to influence Peter Clark.
Well, by then, he was a little older. You're talking... Oh, yeah. So, could you repeat the question?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh,
okay.
There you go, like a singing. Like you're singing.
I was wondering if the society created by some of Peter Clark's contemporaries, being Walter Rauschenbusch and Ida B. Wells... was something that influenced or was affected by Peter Clark?
Well, by then, early 20th century, late 1890s, mm-hmm. by then he was 70, he's in his 70s. Mm-hmm. And he went to St. Louis, and, and while he was in St. Louis, he aligned himself with Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington of the pull yourselves up by your own bootstrap root fame that says society could be as separate as the five fingers, you know, segregationist. Okay, that Booker T. He aligned himself with him and not Du Bois. It's just like I said, the last part of his life was a little, you know, angular to his earlier...
He had baggage, maybe?
Well, I just think, like I said, maybe bitter, disenchanted, disillusioned. But he was very conscious of his own role in history. And so the last chapter of the book, I talk about that. But, yeah, the last part of his life, I would say that he was less of an influence. He was less radical, not even reform-minded. The biggest thing he did after 1879, when he left Cincinnati, was a National Day of Prayer. Okay. That's the most radical that I could find.
Thank you.
I mean, you know.
He did that.
Yeah. Well, the most in quotes, now this time it's in quotes, is the National Day of Prayer, where he wanted everybody to come together and pray for racial healing. He didn't really speak out as firmly against lynching, wasn't as invested in the populist movement, you know, and all these completely, potentially revolutionary moments in American history. So, but I say that it's because he was a little older at the time, a little bit more resigned. His wife had passed. I think that can have profound effect on your hope and your, you know, so she had passed by then. And so it can, all of these things can change you. So I give him, you know, I let him off the hook by the 1890s.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Teresa Wilmot from Rockford, Illinois.
Hi.
The Rockford, Illinois UU Church.
Okay.
I'm interested in what his formal education was. Mm-hmm. Where did he go to college? Did he go to college? And was that normal in that time? Were blacks allowed in college?
Okay, now this gives me a chance to... He went to an abolitionist elementary school, a socialist high school, and he got honorary degree from Oberlin. How many of you went to Oberlin? Yeah, that school is, whoa. He didn't go to Oberlin, but his wife did. And every other black person who was somebody, they went to Oberlin. But it was like one of the most racially progressive, socially progressive schools on the planet. Mm-hmm. And so he was always there, always, you know, doing lectures, but he got an honorary degree, but never got a degree there. He wasn't formally educated, but no, that wasn't common, sadly, for African Americans up until, 1960? So hasn't been common for most of our history. So, yeah, but he was exceptionally educated in that day, you know, having gone all the way through high school. Does that answer your question? Okay, sorry. I wish I could say he went to Penn or Duke, but they didn't exist. At least Duke didn't exist.
Welcome.
Thank you.
My name's Bud Haupt. I'm a member of First Unitarian in Cincinnati.
Yes.
And was a close associate of Walter Hertz, who you've mentioned several times. I worked with Walt when we put up the plaque for Peter Clark.
Right.
And Gaines High School.
Right.
And one of our memories about this history was his role as the first principal of Gaines High School, which was the first high school for blacks in the city.
Right.
And I was wondering if you'd say a little bit about that piece of his
history. His uncle, John Isom Gaines, is the Gaines for which Gaines High School, you know, so Clark didn't attend Gaines, but he was the first principal. Now, kind of connecting this to the young woman's question behind you, it was pretty exceptional to have a black principal of a high school. He was not only principal of Gaines High for a number of years, he also went and became the principal of the Alabama Normal School, which I think now is Alabama A&T or something like that. It's a black school. But he was the principal. After he was in Cincinnati, went to be the principal there, they ran him out of there. And he came back to Cincinnati, and then he went to St. Louis. And so, yeah, it was pretty exceptional because most principals were white at the time. So he had a lot of power. He made a lot of money and was firmly in the black middle class. But that high school, it's exceptional because all of the significant black scientists and even people who were, you know, lecturers and teachers When you look at where they went to school, most of them went to Gaines High School. So it's pretty important. So was the school founded by Gilmore. We call that Cincinnati High School. And so PBS Pinchback, one of the first black politicians from New Orleans, his father sent him to Cincinnati. So Cincinnati in general was just the place. If you wanted your kid to be educated and you were a slave owner and your kid was black, you sent him to Cincinnati. Did you all know that? Yeah, it's pretty weird if you think about it, right? But it's that's the legacy. Hi.
Hi, I'm Bob Nuxall from Shelter Rock on Long Island in New York.
Okay.
I was an educator.
Okay.
I see a tremendous educational possibility here.
Really?
And going here from sort of around the corner.
Okay.
You talk to young people, they will immediately say, how do you turn this into a film?
Right.
I would say, don't want a film. Mm-hmm. I want a two-act play. I want one act with the young Peter. Mm-hmm. Then I want a separate actor mm-hmm. playing an older part mm-hmm. in the second act.
Wow.
And the discussions that would spark.
Right. Oh, I love that idea. Yay. Thank you. Thank you. No more questions?
Let me just add, I think one of the things we, and I'm sure you've kept this in mind too, is how fluid things were in the late 19th century in terms of political parties. And also, you know, we have to keep in mind that by the 1880s, 1890s, the situation for African Americans, whether they were in the South or the North, had become fairly dire. And especially in the South, with Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court case in 1896, right? That just allowed this rampant placement of segregationist policies all across the South. My feeling about, for instance, Booker T. Washington is, you know, he could see the impossibilities and felt that, well, here were these people who had been in slavery, had been working as sharecroppers after the Civil War for so long, and in order to try to begin to move out of that, he didn't foresee yet going to colleges, and he saw the need for practical mm-hmm. kinds of education. Today we feel bad, right, that there wasn't more opportunity, but we have to see, I would suggest to see Clark accommodating to a really awful kind of situation for many black people at that time.
Yeah, especially after 1882.
And lynchings were, you know, really the way to keep people socially immobile, right? They couldn't, there was no little social upward mobility for blacks without fear of being lynched.
Okay. You said that slave owners all over were sending their kids to Cincinnati.
Yes.
You mean they're half black kids, or
well,
they're all kids. Their kids, or
yeah, they're black kids.
Yeah, that's okay. That's
yeah.
interesting.
Yeah, they're black kids. I'm sorry. Yeah, not their white kids. They're black kids because of the strength of these schools, including Gaines High. Later, that's a later period after slavery, but including Cincinnati High School, Gilmore School, and that's where you find PBS Pinchback. You should Google him, and others are there as well. So, yeah.
After slavery.
Before slavery ended, Cincinnati High, and then later, the children of these people are coming up to Cincinnati to be educated. Because you remember, it's still not even, it took a while for education or really get to the level that it needed to be after slavery, in black schools in the South, even after slavery ended. And so they are still sending their kids up to places like Cincinnati's Gaines High School under the direction of Peter Clark. And so a lot of those people, like some of the early black scientists, you find them, your history, you see Gaines High School. And so this is a pretty exceptional place. And so I'm sorry, I misspoke or definitely didn't mean they're white kids. Thank you. No more questions? Let me tell you, you guys are the best audience ever, ever.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Nikki. This is just terrific. Thanks for all your good questions.